don't expect other people to rescue you and really try to take your career into your own hands by, you know, focusing on what's possible rather than trying to just get something bigger for the sake of it being bigger.
If you are a creative in the entertainment industry looking for inspiration and practical ideas about how to take the next steps in your career, you are in the right place. My name is Rebecca Doyle, and I work in film and television in Los Angeles. I learned so much from the ups and downs of the talented, innovative people surrounding me, and I want to share those insights with you. Join in every other week to hear the break-in stories of people who overcame challenges and found unconventional avenues to pursue their dream careers in an industry that has no set path. Hey everyone, happy Valentine's Day. This interview is going to be particularly good for the directors out there, especially if you've ever come across the classic director challenges: turning your short into a feature, getting your first feature in theaters, breaking through to a major film festival after multiple rejections, getting a project scrapped midway through production or after post-production through no fault of the project, navigating representation. Today we're covering it all, and this is honestly one of my favorite episodes to date because of how knowledgeable and candid and unfiltered today's guest was about his experiences. Michael Luke Litwack is a Brooklyn-based filmmaker and cartoonist that was born and raised in Los Angeles. He likes to tell character-driven stories that embrace the absurd, often through a lens of classic genre filmmaking. His first feature was Molly and Max in the Future, a sci-fi rom-com starring Zasha Mamet and Aristotle Atari, and is often described as When Harry Met Sally meets Futurama. Molly and Max had its world premiere at South by Southwest 2023, played at BFI London, Sitges, and Fantasia before its theatrical distribution in February 2024, and is currently sitting at 97% on Rotten Tomatoes. You can tell Michael is someone who has really put the time into developing not only his craft, but also his taste, his relationships, his skills, and his business sensibilities. Every minute of this interview is packed with some wisdom gained from real-world experience, so I can't wait for you to hear the backstory before you buy a ticket today to Molly and Max in the Future. Let's jump into the interview. Michael, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me, and congratulations on the upcoming theatrical release of Molly and Max in the Future.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
So I know we're recording this February 7th. Molly and Max comes out February 9th. So I know you're watching the reviews roll in. What has the reception been like for you so far?
I mean, it's been pretty almost universally positive. So I'm waiting for the other shoe to drop. I'm sure we have some splats coming our way, but right now we're at 96%. You know, we got 15 reviews out of South By, and then we got a couple more over like the extended festival run. And so, you know, we're trying to get to 40 to get certified fresh. You know, any day now I'm going to get like a deluge of review after review after review, but it seems like, you know, people really like the movie and they respond to it. And, you know, even if people have criticisms of certain aspects, like the overall kind of gestalt of the film kind of wins them over. So I feel really happy and grateful for the response. And it seems like a lot of people kind of get it and understand what the movie is. And that's kind of all you can hope for.
And when you say they understand what the movie is, I mean, Molly and Max tackles kind of a lot of issues through the lens of sci-fi and a little bit of satire. What do you think people are missing? And what are you hoping people actually get out of it when they watch?
I mean, you know, I described the movie as When Harry Met Sally in space. And, you know, I think sometimes people use kind of flippant comps for their movie because they want to simplify things. But I think it is very accurate. And I think a lot of people have kind of also commented that that's very accurate. But so I'm really glad that people think that is true, but also acknowledge the fact that it is very different in a lot of ways, and that we've kind of, you know, taking that as a jumping off point and an inspiration, you know, structurally, and then, you know, updated it for a modern audience and took it into a new world and showed them, you know, a side of it that they, you know, haven't seen before.
And I know you mentioned some of these reviews are coming out of South by Southwest. Molly Max played at South by Southwest 2023. So we're coming up on almost the year anniversary of that. Can you tell me about your experience getting into South By and what your experience was at the festival?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, it was like a dream come true. You know, I moved to New York to go to NYU and I started making short films. And, you know, including my NYU shorts. I think I submitted to South by Southwest maybe 12 times with short films, and none of those shorts got into the festival. And so I very much do not like take it for granted, a festival acceptance. And you know, it, you know, we, part of the difference was that I think we were a little bit more strategic, and we brought on some producers with experience with festivals who kind of know that, that circuit and had relationships with different programmers. And, you know, so like, I think the quality of the movie is very high, which also helps. And I also think it is better than a lot of my shorts. But I also think like having that direct kind of access to programmers is something that's important, and whether you can get that via your shorts or via other people who have experience getting their shorts into those festivals, that is really helpful. So, you know, I you kind of get past the sludge of a random submission. And we, you know, submitted and found out that we got in, and we finished the movie like 3 days before South by. So it was kind of this mad dash to the finish line. You know, we had 900 plus VFX shots for the film, and almost all of them were done start to finish by me and the DP on the movie. So it was a two-person VFX team. You know, there's a couple small things that we farmed out to other people, but vast majority was me and Zach Stoltzfus, my DP and VFX supervisor. And so, you know, it's the best feeling in the world to show your movie to an audience of people and have them laugh at the jokes and respond to it. And, you know, I try to go into festivals without like big expectations of a sale or anything. But we were able to get distribution because of South by, and, that's where we met our distributor. They came and saw the movie in a theater. And it kind of set up a lot of things for, you know, us leading to be where we are now.
Okay. That's everything you're saying is such a gold mine of information for people listening. I first want to touch on when you brought on producers that had these relationships, and when you were kind of thinking about that part of the process and how you found them. And then I also want to get into distribution, but before we get there, yeah, how did you get connected with these producers, and at what phase were you thinking about bringing them on?
You know, I think like, different producers had different connections to different festivals. And like, I think everything on most movies is like, you have to find a team of people that have different strengths and weaknesses, and everybody can kind of contribute in different ways. And so, you know, Mallory, Schwartz is a friend from NYU, and we've been very close for a long time. Her and my wife live together, so I was like their roommate when their second unofficial roommate when they were all living together in college. And so I've known her forever. She was one of the people who tried to help me get kind of financing at the very beginning of the process, but she also had a full-time job. You know, she went to the Sundance Lab, so she knew some people there. So it was like, you know, she had those relationships. You know, but I didn't only bring her on because of her Sundance connections. It was, you know, she has a vast network of people and, you know, has been able to contribute to the film in multiple ways. You know, for Ted and Ivy, who were, you know, executive producer and co-producer, you know, I started working with them because Ted is an indie film publicist. He's really experienced. He knows a ton of people. He's also a writer director who has been to South by with his own movies. He actually had a movie at South by at the same year that Malane Max was there. And he's a genre guy. Everybody knows him in the genre world. And I didn't reach out to him again, only because of his festival connections, but I reached out to him because I was in the process of reaching out to literally everyone I've ever met ever to send them an email to be like, hey, I'm working on this movie. And I'm looking for investors, do you know anybody who would be interested? And if you can connect me with somebody who is interested, then like, maybe we can work out some sort of producer credit. And you know, I find that like showing up to somebody and then asking them for a ton of things usually doesn't go very well. But if you can kind of ask people for a small favor or something simple that doesn't take up a lot of their time, and then you can kind of get to know them through that process, you know, people often want to help if they feel appreciated and they feel valued. And so Ted was something where like Ted originally you know, tried to introduce me to a number of people with no strings attached. There was no contracts. There was no like kind of formal agreement. It was just, he was helping me out because I met him at a bar 10 years ago and he liked my shorts. And he was a friendly dude who is also a filmmaker and understands that you need to like be generous with stuff sometimes. So he tried to introduce me to a couple of people. In the process of doing that, he got more excited. He got more involved. He invested a little bit of his own money. And then found another one of our investors, and then became kind of part of the team because he had experience in different ways. And because he has this like publicity background, he knows a ton of people that cover festivals. He goes to them all the time. And so, you know, it's one of those things where different people, you know, and then the people that knew Tribeca were kind of, you know, a slightly different, you know, one step removed, or, you know, it's kind of a patchwork quilt. And then on top of that, like, because of my shorts, even though I hadn't gotten into some of those festivals, I had met programmers from some of those festivals at festivals that my shorts were at. And so even though I didn't get my shorts into them, like playing the short film festival circuit, I was able to kind of meet some of them, and at least get their emails, so that I could, you know, stay kind of on their radar.
And how did you go about doing that? Was this in person, you'd connect with them and then ask for a card, or was this when they sent you communication about the festival after you had submitted?
Both. I had, you know, I met some programmers at like Palm Springs Shorts Fest in person and got their info and, you know, just tried to make a genuine connection with them. But it's hard because they're getting, you know, hassled by every single person there that wants to meet them. And then, you know, I had a number of shorts that like I had submitted and the programmers would email me and be like, hey, you didn't get in, but you almost got in, but like, here's my email in case you want it. So send me your next one. And it didn't necessarily work to get my shorts in, but like, I was at least kind of like on their radar because they liked the movie. And those ones were kind of like 100% blind submissions. So I don't think it was just 100, like, I don't think it was because we knew someone who knew them, but like it was 10 years of like, oh, I recognize this name. This person's been trying for a very long time. And, you know, one of the people who saw my shorts and did not accept them into South By was Claudette, but she had emailed me previously. I had met her at Palm Springs Shorts Fest when she was a shorts film coordinator. And then when it came to submit to South By, like I had met her before and she had moved out of shorts and into feature programming and is now the director of South By Southwest.
So for people that are thinking about these various festivals and trying to determine which, you know, I mean, there's thousands of festivals in the world, right? And so it's important to kind of select which you're going to spend your time on. And it's not realistic to think that every film is going to get into one of these major 10. How are you selecting the other festivals that you were going to go to and build relationships with?
I mean, I don't think it's really worth submitting to a short film festival unless it's one of the top 10 or 15 festivals, unless it is like a specific niche thing that is serving a purpose of like, you are from this specific town in Portland, Oregon, and you have family there and you want to show your movie to your friends and family or something, you know, like, so, but it's like Palm Springs Shorts Fest is a great one. I've never been to Aspen Shorts Fest, but I've heard that it's great. Like places where the filmmakers show up, because I don't think the only point of these things is not to meet programmers. Like it's also to meet the other filmmakers and you know, commiserate and, you know, support each other and, you know, foster genuine relationships so that, you know, that's another thing that you can do is like those people that you meet when you're both making shorts, some of them are able to get their features into these places. And then if they're comfortable kind of like sharing some of those connections, that can be kind of like one way into some of those things.
Makes a lot of sense. Okay, so then you got connected with the distributor who saw your film in a theater, which, as any of my friends know, and I'm an absolute purist about, you have to see a film for the first time in a theater properly, as God intended. So what was the experience like getting distribution out of South By?
I mean, it was, you know, I don't think any of us expected to really get like a full theatrical distribution. I mean, I guess full is a nebulous term, but I mean, I think I'm cynical. I try to go into things with a cynical mindset so that I'm not disappointed. And you know, I was expecting kind of an offer to go straight to video on demand, but this company, Level 33, reached out and they had seen the film and they clearly really cared about it and liked it. And, you know, they were like, yeah, we're thinking theatrical. And I was like, yeah, right. You're lying to me. You're blowing smoke up my ass. And, then they kind of like explained to me their plan and how they have done it before. And, you know, what that really meant and how it would work. And, you know, they kind of won me over. So we had a couple of different offers out of South By, but Level 33 gave us the best deal. They wanted to put it in theaters. And there's also just a lot of other ancillary benefits to being in theaters. Like, we're going to get a New York Times review. You know, we were able to get Zasha on late night because we're in theaters, and those kinds of opportunities are like, they won't happen if your movie goes straight to video on demand. So, you know, I think, you know, we're hopeful that the movie's going to make money in theaters. I don't think anyone's expecting to like get rich off of just the theatrical run, but it is kind of like an additional market where if you go straight to on demand, you get $0 from theatrical. So anything more than $0 is going to be a big win and, you know, move towards, you know, recouping our budget.
And just for the listeners, when Michael says Zasha, he's of course referring to Zasha Mamet, who does a fantastic job starring as Molly and Molly and Max in the future. So Molly and Max was also largely shot on virtual production stages, volume stages, sometimes rear screen projection, LED stages. This is relatively new technology. Can you speak to your experience about spearheading some of this, especially when not many people had been used to working with it before?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I basically wrote a movie to be shot completely on green screen. And at the end of the day, I was ready to shoot it all on green screen if we had to, because I had spent many years trying to get a much bigger film made. And, you know, I wrote this movie very expressively, like with the intention of making it for no money. And then through a series of different events, you know, we were able to find a stage partner, where they had an LED stage built in Bushwick, they were excited about being a part of the movie and they were willing to let us shoot there for a week. And so because of that, you know, like we shot the first whole week on an LED stage. We shot one of those days using virtual production and Unreal Engine, using 3D environments. The rest of those 4 days were shot using 2D plates. So essentially just like video clips put up on a TV screen with the actors standing in front of it, which is the same thing as rear screen projection. And then the last 3 weeks of shooting, we shot a combination of rear screen projection, traditional rear screen projection, which is just an actor standing in front of a, you know, a screen that has a movie projector playing on it. And then we also shot about 30% of the movie on green screen. So, you know, we spent about 18 months, you know, not every day, but kind of, you know, 2 to 3 days a week building out the backgrounds for the film ahead of time, you know, building all of the different miniatures. This is, you know, one of our miniature spaceships that, you know, we built, Zach, my DP, was primarily responsible for building this one. But you know, a lot of it is just kind of kit bashing, using different things. This is like a smart car toy that we, you know, have decorated. These are from a different model kit, that these engines, this tail fin is like from a different model kit. So it's really kind of just combining disparate elements together to make something unique. And similarly, that was kind of part of the writing process, where it was like, okay, we need a little sci-fi building. What can we find online that we can then, you know, make 25 of? And you know, how can we, you know, be creative and, you know, really raise our production value without breaking the bank. So, you know, we spent those 18 months kind of building the backgrounds so that, you know, if we shot a green screen, we'd put them in we'd take out the green screen and put the backgrounds in there. If we ended up finding a stage partner, we could then scale up and, you know, shoot it practically. So I'm really happy that we shot, you know, 50 to 60% of the movie practically in camera. And then, you know, we obviously added some stuff on top and fixed some things here and there, but you know, it was really nice to kind of be able to see things, in camera. Stages are popping up left and right. It's becoming easier and easier. I think like those places need to fill their spaces. And if you can reach out to them and get them excited and they have steady income from other means and they're booking stuff, big stuff, then it all kind of depends upon timing, you know? And so with our thing, it was like, well, if someone had come in and wanted to book the stage on the days that we were there, we would have lost it. But we kind of worked with this stage called The Family, and we basically were like, up until 2 weeks beforehand, if no one books the stage 2 weeks beforehand, then like, can we have that week? And they agreed to do that. And we brought them on board as, you know, I don't think they're technically executive producers, but like their logos at the beginning of the film, you know, they have some profit participation, and we kind of talked with them about, you know, what's most important to you. Is it important to pay the bills up front? Are you okay with waiting? And so I think you have to work out what everybody, you know, what their priorities are, what's most important to them. Like people again are like down to help and do you a favor as long as it doesn't really cost them that much. And this was kind of something where it was like, well, no one was using it that week. We could give it to these indie filmmakers and let them do something cool on it. And then if it's a big success, we'll all profit off of it. But, you know, versus just saying no, and then the stage is just sitting there and nobody's using it.
Yeah. So finding something that works for everybody and everyone's getting something from it. So that's exactly. Great. So Molly and Max. So what's so funny is right before South by last year, I was recording the first episode ever of this podcast with my first ever guest, Brian Tang. And I, for some reason, your short, The Life and Death of Tommy Chaos and Stacey Danger, came up, and he hadn't seen it. And so we watched it maybe a week before South by Southwest. And this is the first time I'd seen it in maybe 6 or 7 years, you know? And then he went to South by Southwest and saw Molly and Max in the future. And he immediately thought, he told me that he thought, wow, there's some real similarities in the directorial style. And then when he found out it was the same, the same guy. So you really have some very clear stylistic aspects of directing, and very clearly those were developing early on at your time in NYU. I want to talk a little bit about the path that got you here, maybe some similarities that you intentionally developed or noticed between Tommy Chaos and Stacey Danger and Molly and Max. So take me back to your thesis film journey in New York.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I kind of grew up watching you know, big budget action adventure spectacle films like Star Wars and Indiana Jones and Jurassic Park. And that's kind of what got me into filmmaking in the first place. And then as I got older, I kind of fell in love with, you know, kind of more character driven films like Annie Hall and When Harry Met Sally and the Before trilogy, and movies that are about kind of people just connecting over conversations and, you know, people walking around New York complaining about their therapists. And, you know, I moved to New York to go to NYU, and I started just making a lot of short films. And in the process of, I think you find your voice and you find your style by doing things, like by just making stuff and kind of seeing what you end up gravitating towards. And what I kind of realized in the process of making a bunch of short films was that, like, I wanted to tell stories that were kind of true to what got me into filmmaking, those big budget action spectacles, but were also kind of true to what kept me in filmmaking, which are those kind of character driven, you know, relatable, realistic films. And so, you know, a lot of it kind of came out of like, well, how do I have a movie set in space or with aliens or with these big budget elements, but without any money to pay for those things for real? And so it kind of just developed out of this need to like, well, I want this thing in there because of the story. How do I pull that off? I need to find a creative way to do that. And so with the short, you know, it was, we had like, the other thing that I kind of learned too was that, you know, when a lot of young filmmakers talk about making their micro budget movies, the scheme is to like go with a group of friends to a cabin or someplace far away, or like everyone wants to shoot their thesis film in their hometown and they have to fly 6 or 7 people out to this hometown. They have to check a bunch of bags to get there. They have to pay for everyone's 3 meals a day and like, and for housing. And it becomes this kind of logistical headache. And I had worked on a ton of those shoots and some of them are super fun, but it like, you know, I think what I realized was like, oh, if you can get your friends, if you shoot inside New York City and you know everyone in New York City, it's so much easier to get people to come and show up because it's not a huge hassle to get them there. And so why don't we make a one location movie, but we'll do it on a studio and we'll turn that location into 10 different locations. And so that was like a kind of logistical proof of concept for the movie too, on a producer side of like, oh, you can use a stage and shoot a micro budget movie on a stage. And so, we shot the Chaos and Danger short over 5 days, I think. And it was, you know, we had 100 different students that worked on it, but it was like, we had a different first AC every day, I think, from what I remember. And so, but it was one of those things where it was like, I can come in between my classes and help out for a little bit because it's a little bit easier and I can go sleep in my own bed at night. And again, like, you know, people will show up and they'll say that they can stay for an hour or two. And then once they realize that it's actually a fun time and that everyone's nice and nobody's like exploiting them, they end up staying for the entire day. And then they want to come back the next day and they ditch class to come, you know? So it's like, I think, you know, again, just like asking for a little bit, gaining people's trust, making them realize that they're part of something different and special, and not forcing them to be there, goes a really long way in terms of like, you know, scaling things up slowly. But so I made my thesis film and, you know, I wanted to kind of tell a story about two people who meet each other and fall in love and run away and then kind of realize that they don't actually have as much in common as they thought they would, because this is, I think, kind of a common relationship story when you're younger, is you think you have this cosmic connection, but then I think a lot of couples kind of go through a period of kind of questioning, oh, like, what is actually our relationship based off of? Is it just because we're attracted to one another, or do we have something kind of deeper there? And so to me, like, whenever I write anything, it kind of starts from like, what's the feeling that I want to get across? And then how can I use metaphor and allegory to kind of explore that and try to show a visual way and give people an experience about, you know, communicating an emotional experience. And so, you know, I made that short and it got rejected from Sundance. It got rejected from South By, from Tribeca, from Cannes, from everywhere. And
wow.
Yeah. And I was basically like, oh, wow, I guess nobody likes this movie and it's not going to do anything for me. And in the course of like 2 weeks, like there was a complete 180, because I had a friend who was a couple years ahead of me, and he had been working in development at a company, and he saw the short and was like, this is great, can I send it to some people? And I was like, sure, nobody else likes it, send it to whoever you want. And he sent it to a couple different agents and managers, and then they sent it to a couple people, and then those people, and like overnight the password protected Vimeo link kind of went viral. And then that next week we ended up winning the NYU festival, which was like also like a big thing for the film. So you know, suddenly I went from just like getting constantly rejected to, you know, winning a big prize, and then, you know, suddenly getting a lot of attention from agents and managers. And so I had 5 agencies and 11 management companies that were basically chasing me for like 2 or 3 weeks. And I did a whole water bottle tour, but I didn't have a script ready. You know, like I just put 110% of my energy and my life into making shorts. And I had never like fully finished even a draft of a feature script. And so I was getting all these opportunities, but I couldn't necessarily like really take advantage of them because I didn't have something ready. And so I basically worked, you know, I was able to pitch some ideas and set up some small writing deals with different companies that had development funds, and kind of parlayed the success of the short into some development jobs. And, you know, those were kind of a mixed bag. Some of them were really amazing experiences where like I met people that I really respect and really love and had, you know, really fruitful creative collaborations, even if the project didn't get off the ground. And then other experiences were nightmare horror stories where I worked with people who were really, you know, uncaring exploitative and sleazy and kind of the Hollywood cliche of like, you know, people that don't care about anything other than money and, you know, don't really care about the quality of product. So, you know, it really was kind of a roller coaster ride and every job was different. And, you know, at the same time I got, you know, my agent got me a couple of interesting jobs that were all kind of small, but, you know, I worked on a digital series that was a really great experience. And that was, there was a platform that Verizon Wireless spent $1 billion trying to get off the ground. Called Go90. Yeah. And, you know, it's really hard to get hired at like as a feature director on something if you don't have, if you only have shorts, but I was able to get this digital series that was, you know, it was like a $2.5 million budget. It was produced by Warner Brothers. It was season three of this show. And it was honestly one of the best experiences I've ever had. Like everyone on that team was incredible. And they were so welcoming. They were so trusting. They were like real filmmakers. So much of the stuff on Go90 was like garbage, but they like their stuff was really, really good, actually good. Mm. And, they welcomed me in with open arms and, you know, they had tried to make they had made a short that then got picked up by Go90 to be turned into a series. And then, they greenlit season two and season three, and they took a feature that they had written and that was season one and season two. And so they brought me on to direct season three, and I moved out to Utah for 4 months. I got to shoot this movie with basically a 25-day shoot with like 40-foot sets and stunt people and explosions and like all this fun stuff. It was like so, so cool. And we edited it and we finished like I think we picture locked in like 7 weeks. It was crazy, but it like really, really proud of it. And I was like, wow, this is going to be the thing that like helps me get to the next level. And like we turned it in, and then like the next day Verizon Go90 shuts down.
No.
And, yeah. And the project gets shelved. It's never going to see the light of day. No one will ever see it. I can put it on my reel, but like that. And I was like, well, surely I have a $2.5 million thing under my belt. Like the production value is insane. Like it shows that I know how to direct, like that I can handle that responsibility. Also that I can like work within a studio system. Like surely this will open up other opportunities. And like, it was just like crickets, like because nobody cared that it was a digital series. Like they were just like, well, call us when you have a feature. So it was very frustrating because I was also really proud of it. You know, stuff gets shelved all the time. It's not unique to me, but it was, you know, a little bit demoralizing. So, you know, there was kind of this long 7 or 8 year period between the success of my thesis film and the start of Molly and Max where, you know, I was kind of doing odd jobs here and there. I got hired to work on this VR series and I developed a project with Paul Feig's company. And that was a really incredible, like positive experience. And, you know, I learned a little bit at each of them. But the whole time I was like, I want to make the Chaos and Danger feature. I want to, I had been working on that script, and finally, after, you know, 6 years, I had a script that I was really proud of. And I was like, this is the movie that I want to make as my first feature. Cause some of those other experiences, like I would write the movie, we'd get it set up, we'd go through the chicken and egg of casting. It would fall apart. People would lose interest. The person at the company would move to somewhere else. It was just kind of this like endless start and stop. But those other movies fell apart. And I was like, okay, that's all right. Because now the Chaos and Danger movies is ready. I'm going to make that. We got a budget made. We got two, you know, well-known actors attached. We got foreign sales estimates. And we set a date for June 2020.
So we know how that went.
So we know how that went. So March 2020, obviously that all falls apart. Like the indie film landscape completely changes overnight. It's like, you know, it goes from being like, oh, it looks like this is maybe going to happen to, oh no, this is dead. And nothing ever dies quickly. It's always like a slow death of like, let's just check it back in a couple of weeks. And then, you know, months go by. And so, but I very quickly was just like, oh, this isn't going to happen. And then during the pandemic, I lost my reps. And one of them by choice, the other one not by choice. But I kind of was like at a point where I didn't you know, I kind of had nothing to lose anymore. And I, you know, originally when my short film didn't do well, I was like, all right, I guess I'll go make a micro budget feature. And then once I got reps, I was like, oh no, I should aim higher. I should try to get like a $5 or $10 million movie made because I have these pathways to potentially do that. And so I spent a lot of years chasing that. And finally, once I kind of struck out and the pandemic kind of ruined a lot of things, I was like, all right, I got to go make a micro budget feature now. And so I went back to the drawing board and I was like, you know, how can I take all the lessons I've learned over the last 10 years and, you know, turn them into a movie that I'm proud of and make my version of a micro budget movie that, you know, is like all of the movies that I grew up loving and also like the movies that, you know, kept me in making movies at the same time. And so part of that was also like in the early pandemic, we started binging Pixar movies because we were like, I love a good theme. I'm like, let's just go through the oeuvre of Pixar. And then we got through Pixar and we were like, let's do rom-coms. We started going through the oeuvre of rom-coms and eventually found When Harry Met Sally. And like, it's such a perfect movie. I have no, you know, I wouldn't change a frame of it, but it was interesting to watch it in a time where you couldn't go outside and you were afraid of dying, potentially of getting sick and dying. And also Trump was the president and it just felt like every day we were just like stuck in this chaotic hellhole that was completely outside of our control. And you watch When Harry Met Sally and like, you have no idea what they even do for a living. They're like, he's a political consultant, I think they mentioned at one point, but like, you don't even know what party, like you have no idea like what they do outside of their relationship. And there's something really nice about that because it is just 100% focused on their personal lives. But at the same time, as someone whose like career is such a big part of my identity, like, and my career had completely stalled because of no fault of my own. And so, you know, I was like, well, how would you do When Harry Met Sally if you did it today? How would you kind of update a story of two people meeting over and over again? And how would you kind of integrate these things that the original doesn't kind of touch on, whether it's race and class and gender and, you know, capitalism and politics and, you know, all of these things that take up a lot of time are often the things that I talk about with my friends, you know, so, you know, and ultimately how do our relationships kind of help us get through some of those things that feel very overwhelming. And, you know, what is it like to be living in 2021 or 22 or 23, like in a world that feels constantly overwhelming with climate change, with the nonstop dumpster fire that is US politics. You know, how do we kind of, you know, lean on the people that we care about, and that care about us to kind of help us reckon with some of these things that can be so overwhelming. So the Molly and Max kind of like really started from wanting to explore that. And, you know, I wrote it to be shot all on a green screen. And if I had to, I was going to shoot it in my living room. And luckily we were able to move out of my living room. But again, it was like you start small and then you scale up slowly and you can't do it all by yourself, but you can, I think, bring the ball, you know, 80% of the way there on a lot of fronts. And then the people that get involved will see that you are not just going to dump something in their lap and expect them to do all the hard work for you.
Okay, we've covered a lot in the last few minutes. This is all such good information, Michael. Thanks so much for sharing your journey, especially so transparently, because you've overcome a lot to get here. backing up a little bit to representation. So you landed these reps. You're very sought after by reps because of Tommy Chaos and Stacey Danger, your short film from NYU. That in itself, I think, is really going to be interesting for listeners because, yeah, you really kind of circumvented the entire festival circuit. And despite rejection from some of these festivals, we're able to get exactly what people are hoping to get out of the festival circuit, which is really amazing. So this is, I mean, we're talking over eight years ago now. And then since then, you know, you said that you lost some of those reps, some by choice, some not by choice. Can you tell me more about kind of your journey navigating different managers, agents, representation, what you would recommend someone maybe looking for their first one, and what are the things that you prioritize now?
Yeah, totally. I mean, you know, I think having a rep is sometimes it can feel like a significant other sometimes. And you know, I've parted ways with certain reps. I haven't had that many different reps, but like, you know, my first manager, I really like the guy. I respect him. I have nothing against him. I have like no ill will towards him. And I remember like calling him and it felt like I was like breaking up with a girl where I was just like, I hope he doesn't hate me. Like, oh, but it was just like, and it was truly like the feeling was mutual. He was like, it's no hard feelings. Like it is time to move on. You're right. Like, thanks for, you know, I still believe in you. I wish you nothing but the best. And like, you know, if I ran into that guy at a party, I'd be like, hey man, how are you? Like, so truly, like, I think it can feel like a very intimate relationship because you're talking to them once a week. You're sharing your scripts and your hopes and your dreams with them. And they can, you know, they see you in vulnerable states where you get rejected by people too. And so, you know, I think, honestly, I think it's really hard for a rep to get a director or anything off of just a short film. And I think that there's kind of this myth of this pathway of like, you make a short and then you get a rep and then they help you get your feature made. And it's not impossible. Like I've seen it happen before. So it's not like completely impossible. I'd say that though, I know 9 out of 10 people who get a short and get a rep that end up kind of languishing on somebody's roster and waiting for their rep to bring them opportunities. And like, I mean, I did hundreds of meetings, you know, like, and those pay off in different ways. So it's not like completely useless, but at the end of the day, like, you know, your manager is not going to raise the money for your movie. It's possible that they can introduce you to a producer who could, but you're rolling the dice and waiting for someone else to take an interest in you. So, you know, so much of it is positioning. If you have, but I also think it's really hard for those people to do something for you if you aren't ready. And they all have 20, 30, 40, 50 clients each. They get a new script from a new client every week. You know, they'll send your script out to 5 or 10 people. And if the first 5 or 10 people don't really bite, then, you know, they take that as a sign that people don't really want it. And then they'll say, send me the next one, you know? And so I think it's really kind of easy to burn out doing that. And, you know, again, like no shade to anyone. There's a million ways to kind of make your path. There is no set path, as they say. And so I think, you know, I don't want to say that that's like a waste of time, but what worked for me was once I stopped expecting my reps to be the people that were going to get me things. And like, they did get me some opportunities, like, and again, they set up a lot of meetings. I built some relationships and connections from those meetings. And some of them were able to transfer into, you know, opportunities, but like for Molly and Max, like, you know, I really love my new manager, but I also think part of it is because I don't expect him to do everything. And I think that was like one of the mistakes I made where I was like, all right, fine, I can sit back and relax. And now this person can be the one who's out there hustling. And, you know, I think you do need reps at a certain point. Like, I'm not anti-rep. You know, my manager is in the process of trying to help me get my next film set up. And he's sending it out to a ton of people. And just like that access is really important. And getting people to read your stuff is important. But I also think, especially for your first film, to get past this kind of catch-22 chicken or egg of like, we won't take you seriously until you have your first movie. Like, I do think that going the micro budget route and doing it yourself and suffering a lot to do it is, you know, I kind of just reached a point where I was like, okay, this is worth it now because I've tried the other way and it didn't work. And, you know, I at least, you know, I spent those 7 years where I wrote a new script and a new pilot every year. And some of them got farther than others and some of them almost got there, you know, and if the pandemic hadn't happened, maybe that would have been the success story would have been that like that path worked for me. But it's not the way the cards were dealt. And so I've kind of just reached a point where I was like, rather than spending another year writing a new script and writing a new pilot, like, why don't I spend that year learning how to do visual effects and then doing those visual effects on my own movie? And then I won't have to raise all this money to have a huge budget because I can just do the visual effects myself.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. That sounds very similar to Brian Tang as well. And you guys both had really great outcomes from South By the last year. So definitely something to take away here. Okay, so we talked about how the pandemic affected you, how you navigated that, overcome the setbacks there. Did you face any similar struggles with the strikes last year?
You know, the strike was 100% necessary. And, you know, I'm really glad that all of those writers stood up for what was right and, you know, fought for those, the things that they fought for, because it affects the entire industry. And, you know, I plan to join the WGA one day. So I came out of South By and I finally have a feature under my belt. So I started doing meetings again. And right as you start to get momentum, the strike happens. And then obviously you have to respect that. And even though I'm not WGA, like, it's just, you never want to go against that for multiple reasons, including that it's ethically wrong. But, you know, so that kind of shut everything down for 6 months. Half the people that I met at those companies once the strike ended, no longer work there. And it was a bummer because I felt like there were some real opportunities, that, like, I came out of South By, there was a lot of momentum, and I met with a couple companies that were like, we have this concrete project that I think you would be a good writer on. Like, let's keep talking about it. And, which is different than, you know, a kind of general meeting where you're like, you just kind of meet and chat and you don't know if it'll go anywhere. And so, and then basically all of those opportunities, evaporated. But at the same time, you know, like, I had the Chaos and Danger feature. I was, out of South By. I was like, okay, now I'm going to go make this one. And, because of the writer's strike, you know, I got to take some time and think about, like, well, is this really the movie that I want to make as my second movie? You know, yeah, who knows if something else will pop up that isn't this, but I was like, is this, you know, this is also a love story. I want to make that movie one day, but I was like, well, I finally have time and no one's asking me for scripts right now because it's the strike. So why don't I go back to the drawing board and think about, you know, if I were to not have this other script ready, what would I want to do next? And so that's kind of how I came up with the concept for my next movie. And, you know, I had those couple of months where I could write that movie on my own time and not feel rushed or feel pressure to, like, get something out there and take advantage of the South by Southwest momentum. And, you know, so I'm honestly really happy. And so that I was able to take that time.
Well, I'm glad you were able to find a silver lining in how you could use that time. Something else that you started doing even before the strikes was, drawing cartoons. Can you tell me about that aspect of your storytelling career?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think movies take so much time to get made. There's so many false starts. There's so many stops. And it can get really creatively frustrating to have something in your mind and you want to go make it. And then you have to wait 2 weeks because someone's on vacation. And the thing about Hollywood is someone is always on vacation. And there's always an excuse to be out of the office. There's a festival or something. And so things just move at, like, a very glacial pace, and that's the way it is. And that's okay. And you have to kind of come to terms with it. But in the meantime, you know, I think it's important to have a kind of creative hobby, that isn't wrapped up in the kind of baggage of your career. And so in the middle of the pandemic, when everything was on halt, you know, I started drawing New Yorker style cartoons, and I kind of fell in love with it as a little form. And, you know, I think musicians can kind of practice their scales, you know, and that you can do these, like, small, like, little exercises. But as a filmmaker, even if you're making a short film, like, that can be a monumental kind of, you know, lift. You know, it takes so much time and energy and money to make a short film, even though that's supposed to be the easy version of filmmaking, and it isn't. And so drawing a cartoon is something that, like, I can do on my own with nobody else there, and I can, you know, be done with it in an hour. I have a completed thing at the end of it, and I can share it with people and they laugh, and I get a lot of kind of personal fulfillment out of it. And, you know, I submit them to some magazines and I've gotten published in some, but it's really, it's like, it doesn't, I'm not in it for that. I'm in it because it makes me happy and it allows me to be creative in a way that is satisfying and that like holds me over in between kind of these long periods of logistics and waiting and kind of bullshit that is just like an inherent part of working in film and TV.
Yeah, totally get it. I feel like that's what this podcast is for me. So I totally understand having something to creatively fulfill you in the interim. Okay, so one other thing I want to touch on before we get to the upcoming projects is you're one of few people that I personally know who is featured on the esteemed Humans of New York. Could you tell me how that happened?
Oh, wow. That was so long ago. I mean, I was sitting on a bench and a guy came up to me and asked me a couple questions and then walked away. And I was like, all right. And then somebody else messaged me and was like, hey, you're on Humans of New York. And I was like, I don't know what that is. So then I looked it up and it's pretty cool.
Oh, that's crazy. Wow. Okay. I'm glad you got to discover it through being on it. That's a rarity. Okay, so looking to the future, word on the street is that you have a futuristic heist film. Is that the Tommy Chaos and Stacey Danger feature, or is this the new script?
This is the new script. It's a sci-fi western heist. So I don't want to say too much about it, but for sure. That's my kind of number one priority at the moment. But I don't know. You have to kind of stay open to wherever life takes you, and you know, it's very much possible that something will pop up and take me kind of in a different direction. But I love this new script. I love this new movie, and I'm really excited to you know, start pushing the boulder up the hill again.
Okay, so getting into some advice for people, how has your living situation impacted your creativity over the years? And I'd even take it a step further and say, you know, how have you navigated creativity or changed your workflow since being married? Because that's a huge life change. And like you said, our jobs and entertainment are kind of melded with parts of our identity. So navigating that when you have a whole other person that you're committed to has got to be its own process. So how have those things impacted your creativity?
I mean, I have an incredibly supportive partner emotionally and financially too. You know, like I think as a filmmaker, like you have to, it's like an addiction, you know, like I spend so much of my own personal income over the years of like investment in my own career. And, you know, you can look at it as financial investment or financial irresponsibility, kind of depends on what the end result is. But, you know, it takes a kind of understanding of that and willingness to kind of sacrifice things in order to do that. And I luckily have like an incredibly supportive wife who also works in the film industry and, you know, understands that unpredictable nature of things. But on the, you know, on the flip side, like also has a more kind of stable version of the job, because I think becoming a writer or becoming a director is kind of the most unstable, unpredictable pathway within film and TV. And she works as an editor and has a little bit more stability because of that. So, you know, it honestly, you know, being able to split the rent with somebody is huge, like moving in. I mean, that is, you know, makes everything so much easier. But and then, you know, having someone who kind of gets the requirements of the job description is really, really amazing, and I feel very grateful to have that.
Yeah, definitely. What would your advice be to someone looking to get started along the path that you've gone? And I know, you know, the system changes so quickly that the advice that might have worked for you when you were graduating NYU, so much has changed, so much new technology has come out. But generally, what would your advice be for someone looking to get started?
I mean, I think people, and myself included, kind of make the mistake of looking at things as like purely stepping stones. And I think there's this emphasis on like, you just have to make one short film and that is what will catapult you. And then you just have to make one feature film and that's what will catapult you. And like, I think changing your kind of mindset to like, I need to build a body of work and build a variety of skills and really learn by doing is really, really important. And I think that, you know, you get to quality through quantity. And so whenever I talk to young filmmakers, I'm like, it's better to make 10 $1,000 shorts than it is to make one $10,000 short. And eventually, you know, you do want to make that $10,000 short and scale up. But I also think it's important to not think the next thing needs to be bigger, the next thing needs to be bigger. And, you know, scale up and down is necessary, but I also think like kind of waiting for someone to come in and rescue you, whether it's a representative or another producer, is also kind of like a mistake that I made, where I think, you know, I don't really have a desire to work on VFX on other people's movies. I also like don't really have that much of a desire to be super involved in the producing of other people's films, but I had to learn those producing skills. I had to learn those VFX skills because you need to be able to wear multiple hats on your movie. And if you're working, you know, I worked with an incredible team of producers, but I was able to pick up some of the slack of when they're at their day jobs and I'm at my day job and they can pick up the slack for me. So it's like being able to contribute to your team in more ways than just writing and directing. Cause I think it's very tempting to be like, I just want to be a writer. I just want to be a director. Like, and I don't know, there's maybe, you know, that pathway works for some people, but it didn't work for me. So I think, you know, building up those additional skills in addition to what you're doing has benefits in a lot of different ways. And, you know, while I never wanted to learn as much VFX as I did, I'm so glad I did, because now ideally when I can work with a team of VFX artists, like I know how to talk to them and I know how to appreciate their work and I know how to guide them. And it's really helped me as a director to learn that. And same thing with the producing skills. So I think, you know, don't expect other people to rescue you, and really try to take your career into your own hand by making things small, making them with your friends, you know, focusing on what's possible rather than trying to just get something bigger for the sake of it being bigger.
Mm. So kind of like an entrepreneurial, relatively sustainable mindset.
Definitely.
Okay, I've been so excited to ask you this question before we get into our time capsule, because I feel like you have just overcome so much and there were so many low points. Getting your Go 90 series pulled is devastating. Having projects fall apart is always frustrating, no matter how common it is in the industry. During all of these kind of crushing times, what were the things that kept you going, and did you ever consider giving up?
I feel like whenever I'm at a low point, I try to like watch a movie that is like inspiring. And I think like when you watch a masterpiece, like Rushmore is one of my favorite movies. And I feel like whenever the credits roll on Rushmore, I'm like, let's watch it again right now. And it like, it fills me up with so much joy and like reminds you about like why you're doing this and why you have chosen this life and why you've done this to yourself. So, you know, I think just like refreshing your love for movies, has been, you know, is something that you need to do continually. And I think also just having an incredibly supportive partner has helped me kind of get through a lot of this. And you know, I think, did I miss part of the question?
Did you ever consider giving up and doing something else?
Not really. I mean, like Wynton Marsalis has a quote where he's like, if you have a backup plan, you're going to do that. And that's always spoken to me, because like I don't think I could be a full-time VFX artist. And I, you know, like I worked as a freelance editor out of school, and sometimes every now and then I'll pick up an editing gig just to make a little bit of extra money. But you know, I've kind of put all of my chips into directing, and so it's too late to back out now.
Okay. Now we can get into our time capsule segment. The time capsule is to freeze this moment in time and to make some predictions for the future. So if we start with the past, if you could write yourself a letter 10 years ago, so this would be 2014, what would you say?
I'd honestly just send them the recording of this podcast and just say, listen to this and, you know, don't make all the mistakes you made. But I don't know. I also learned a ton because of those mistakes. So I think it's one of those things like in retrospect, I got out of film school and I got reps and I was like, sweet, I'm going to have my first feature made by the time I'm 24. It's going to be amazing. And it didn't happen until I was like 32. And, you know, I definitely think I could have avoided some of those bad experiences and still been able to, you know, make a good movie. But I think all of those things kind of contribute to who I am now. And I am grateful to be where I am. So I guess in retrospect, I had to go through it. But, you know, I'd maybe tell my younger self to just chill out a little bit and go for a walk and find a work-life balance better sooner. Mm.
Would that advice change if you were speaking to yourself 5 years ago? So 2019.
I don't know. I don't think so. I mean, I felt like that 5 years ago was like kind of the turning point because Snatchers like happened in 2019. And that was like right when things started kind of taking a downhill trajectory. So
Snatchers the Go 90 series.
Yeah. I think that advice would apply to 2019, Michael.
Okay, then moving on to the present, what is your favorite song right now?
I'm terrible with song titles, but I really like the new Future Islands album. What is it called? Oh God. Future Islands. King of Sweden is one of the songs from that album. It's the album is People Who Aren't There Anymore. I just love Future Islands. I think they're a great band and they're also incredible live. They put on a really amazing show.
What is your favorite TV show right now?
We are almost done rewatching BoJack Horseman and I think it's just one of the best shows ever made. I mean, I think it's genius. Every episode's incredible. And it's interesting because I remember when I first started watching it, I was like, whenever I would tell people to watch it, I'd be like, okay, the first season, it's a little bit clunky, but by the end of it, it finds its voice, like just stick with it. And then, you know, I was able to convince a number of friends to watch it and you know, everybody was like, yeah, you know, it didn't hook me at first, but then I gave it some time and I really fell in love with it. And it was interesting rewatching it because I went back this time and I was like, all right, I've said this 1,000 times that like the first half of the first season isn't that great. And then I went and rewatched it and I was like, no, this is amazing. I just hadn't like learned the style and the sense of humor of the show yet. And by the, you know, on second viewing, I'm like, no, the first season's amazing. It's great. Like once you get the show, it totally works, which has never happened to me before. It's kind of cool.
Yeah, I would hard agree. I love the first season. What is the best movie you've seen in the last year?
I really love Poor Things. I thought that was great. I thought Zone of Interest was really incredible. I loved Wonka. I'm a Paul King stan. Paddington 2, one of the best movies ever. And I loved Wonka. You know, Wonka, Zone of Interest, double feature, highly recommend. that's enough.
What food or drink item are you currently obsessed with?
Food or drink item. I mean, I've been obsessed with this for a long time, but there's a Mexican food place in New York called Calexico, and their burritos are like just the best thing ever. Even better than West Coast burritos, which are very good. So
that shot's fired.
Yeah, I know. But you gotta come and try it. It's great. So that's probably my number one.
What was the most surprising thing you learned from Molly and Max in the Future? And this could be about the technology or casting or a way of communicating with actors. It could be any little detail.
I think like, I don't know if it's that surprising, but like just the amount of endurance that a long shoot takes, I think is really like, it's really hard to replicate on shorts. And I had Snatchers, which was, a 25-day shoot, but because it was a bigger budget, there were a lot more kind of like creature comforts And I didn't have to wear as many hats. So I think that was, you know, just the amount of endurance and kind of like decision fatigue you suffer through when making something over, you know, 4 or 5 weeks, it's really, really difficult. You know, the other thing was, you know, working with so much VFX, and working on a stage, and like, you know, we finished the movie, or we didn't finish the movie. We were editing the movie and we realized that we needed more wide shots because stuff, the coverage felt kind of, you know, claustrophobic. And so if I had to do it again, you know, and we were able to kind of fix it by adding in VFX wide shots, afterwards. And, you know, we did a lot of testing on the film and were able to get people's like candid feedback. And, it seemed in the process of adding those wide shots, we kind of like opened up the film and were able to spread it out. But I think because we shot on such a small stage, you know, we kind of limited some of our coverage. And if, you know, that was, I think, a lesson learned of like, you really have to make sure that there's a variety in the way you shoot things. Because if not, then it will get kind of too visually repetitive.
What is the most recent lesson that you've learned outside of filmmaking? This could be about, you know, the New York subway, relationships, friendships, travel.
I guess I've kind of like, over the last year, I've just like learned to stop drinking. Like, and I never drank a lot beforehand, but I'm just like, I used to feel kind of like go out and default to like, I'll have a beer or two or something. And I think the older I get, the harder it is to like get even just like, even if I have one beer, like wake up with a full night of sleep. And so I've just kind of stopped like defaulting to like having a beer. I still have one every now and then, but I've just like tried to take a little bit more like care of my health and be like, do I actually want this beer, or am I defaulting to just having that? And can I just get a seltzer or something different? I don't know, something small, but it pops up a lot actually.
Yeah, no, I also think that's a collective thing people are learning. Like the mocktail industry is kind of exploding, and I haven't had a full drink since 2021 either. So I feel like a lot of people are on the same wavelength. Yeah. Who would be dream collaborators for you?
I love Emma Stone. I think she's pretty amazing. I think she's funny and has like so much depth to her. So I think like, yeah, it would be an absolute dream to work with her on anything. In terms of male actors, I'm trying to think. Who's good right now? Oh, Mark Ruffalo. I'm just they say in the cast of four things. But he was so good in that movie. He was incredible. Yeah.
Four Things, the sci-fi heist spinoff.
Yes.
Coming to you. Yeah. What are your current interests or hobbies outside of work?
So I love cartooning. That is big. I have a dog that I like to play with and take her on walks. You know, work has been kind of consuming lately. So this is maybe not the best time to ask, but
everyone always says that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think drawing and just reading about something that doesn't have to do with filmmaking is, you know, I think sometimes like, a way to kind of cheat the, you know, you want to always feel productive, but then you feel too burnt out if you're only focused on work is like, you know, this next movie I'm working on is a Western. And so I was just like, oh, and let me just watch a bunch of Westerns. And it's kind of a way to make leisure time feel a little bit more, I guess, effective. But then, you know, I kind of have learned a lot about that genre, and, you know, I am genuinely interested in it. And so to me, it's like, it doesn't necessarily feel like work. It is the fun part of work, which is learning about movies and movie history. And, You know, I also, the other thing is surfing. I really love surfing. That's my like go-to outside of work hobby, but I can't really do it in New York in the winter. So whenever I'm in LA, I try to go surfing almost every other day. So
amazing. Where's your surf spot?
I usually go to El Porto.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Yeah.
I go to El Porto, but the last couple of times I was there, it wasn't good. So I've been going up to like Sunset or, you know, Malibu or, you know, any number of spots.
You just have the rocks up there. That's what scares me about Malibu. Yeah. El Porto, you wipe out, but
are you a surfer?
Yeah. Yeah.
Really?
I'm kind of more, I'm not very good at it, but it's good for my ego to do something that's, you know, you get knocked down a lot at, but I really enjoy it. Yeah. And El Porto is also,
I'm very mediocre. I do not claim to be good at it, but I really love it. And I think it's like, it's physical. You're not on your phone. You're in nature. Like, you know, I also, what I love to do is to stay on New York time so that then I basically wake up at 5 a.m. in Los Angeles and I can be out on the water as like the sun is rising, and it's magical.
All the pros. Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely. Okay. I know you mentioned you have a dog. Who are your pets?
I can show you. This is Maple.
Aww.
This is Maple. She's a
Molly and Max.
She loves it. She's in it. If you that's actually the most important lesson I've learned, is that you should sneak your animals, photos of your animals into your projects, no matter the cost. So she's in the background of a newspaper clipping, and the headline says dog wins cutest dog in the Galaxy Award. So she's a celebrity and I'm a stage parent. But so she's nine different breeds. She's like, funnily enough, she's 33% Chihuahua, which is her biggest breed.
Wow.
Even though she's kind of big, she's 35 pounds. Her biggest breed is Chihuahua. Her second biggest breed is Boxer. And so she's just a little box Wawa.
Box Wawa. Amazing. Do you have any tattoos?
I don't. No, my mom is very anti-tattoo and has made it extremely clear to me that she would freak out if I got a tattoo. So I'm, you know, just want to avoid her being annoyed with me.
I relate to that. Yeah. Moving on to the future. The year is 2029. Where are you hoping you will be living?
2029, what year is it right now? 2024, so 5 years from now. I mean, I love living in Brooklyn. You know, we have been here for a long time. We're planning to stay here for a long time. So, you know, honestly, love being in Clinton Hill. We, you know, are planning to have a kid sometime in the next couple of years. So, you know, hopefully that doesn't force us to move to a different neighborhood, which I'm sure it will eventually. But, I honestly would be super happy if we're still on Clinton Hill in 5 years.
Okay. The year is 2029. What is your anniversary gift for your wife?
I feel like we try to just have experiences together because like neither of us really need anything like physical. We just are very lucky and don't really need anything like material that we don't already have. So it's like we try to go on trips or go on experiences together. So I think it would depend. You know, I think the Olympics are 2029, so maybe we'll go to those and go see the U.S. play in the women's soccer. We'll see.
I think that's L.A. too, right? So you can get in some surfing while you're doing
exactly.
that.
Exactly. Yeah.
And go to all the N.A. mocktail bars, which are popping up out here.
Yeah.
Okay, the year is 2029. What are Molly and Max up to? And actually, now that I think about it, this is going to be in the past for Molly and Max, huh? 2029.
Oh, I guess so, technically, yeah.
So, so better question, 5 years in the future for Molly and Max, what are they up to?
I don't know. I mean, someone just asked me if, like, would you ever do a sequel? And I'm like, I'm not opposed to it on a theoretical level, but it's not something I want to do immediately. So I think it would be like a before trilogy kind of thing where, you know, maybe in 5 or 10 years, we reevaluate and see if the movie has enough of a cult following and people want to see it, then, I can start thinking about it. But until then, I'm moving on to other stuff.
Yeah, for sure. The year is 2029. What do you hope has happened by this point with Tommy Chaos and Stacey Danger?
The characters or the project?
I guess both. Yeah.
I hope that they're, as characters, they're living their best life and have found a balance and make each other happy. I think I love that script. I would love to make that movie one day. But it just requires so much willpower to get a film made that I think you really need to feel like everything lines up in terms of timing and positioning and politics and stuff like that. And so, I think if someone were to knock on my door and say, I have, $1 billion, do you want to go make this movie? The answer would be hell yeah, but that's never going to happen. So it's a kind of a matter of like, where do I want to put my energy? Where do I want to put my priorities? Mm-hmm. And it takes so much time and energy to get anything made that it really needs to be the thing that I believe in 110% for multiple reasons other than just the creative.
Mm. The year is 2029. What is one thing you hope will have been invented?
Something to capture carbon from the atmosphere.
That's a very popular response. Yeah, people are very hopeful about climate change inventions. Reverse climate change adventures, I should say. Yeah. Okay. For our last question, I'd love for you to leave a voicemail for yourself to listen to in 2029.
Oh, boy. Keep on trucking, man. That's all I'll say.
Awesome. Well, Michael, thank you so much for your time. Where can people keep up with you online? And also, where can they see Molly and Max and its release?
So it'll be at the Lemley NoHo and at the Lemley Monica from the 9th to the 15th, at least, maybe more, we'll see. It'll be at Cinema Village in New York, and there's a list of theaters participating across the country at mollyandmax.com. It's Molly spelled with an I instead of a Y. I am on Instagram at Michael Litwack. And there's also an at Molly and Max account, but we just post the same things. There's a bunch of behind the scenes stuff on there that go through kind of the making of the film. That's where I'll be living until, like all social media platforms, they eventually get replaced by something else.
Awesome. Well, Michael, thank you so much for your time. Cannot wait for the film to hit theaters in just a few days here. And looking forward to everything that you're up to next. So thank you for coming on.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Here is a recap of some takeaways from my conversation with Michael. 1, ask people for small favors and get to know them through the process. People want to help if they feel appreciated and valued. 2, in addition to submitting a quality film, having access to programmers via producers or other people with major festival experience will greatly help you in landing your film at a top fest. 3. Connecting with festival programmers in person or online is a worthwhile outcome of submitting to festivals, even if your film is not selected that round. 4. Developing skills like producing and VFX will add to what you can offer as a director, especially when trying to achieve your vision on a budget. 5. Rejection from major festivals is not always an indicator of general interest in a film. A short sent to the right person can generate the interest one would hope to gain through festival exposure. 6. Reps can help build connections, but it's generally unwise to expect them to entirely replace your effort in doing all of the work of hustling for your career. 7. Instead of seeing every opportunity as a major launch pad to a huge break or meteoric rise, think of your career as building a body of work and developing a variety of skills through experience. 8. Scale up and down as necessary. 9. Don't expect other people to rescue you. Take your career into your own hands by focusing on what's possible, even if small projects, rather than trying to make something bigger for the sake of being bigger. And 10. Productivity hack. To feel productive while getting leisure time, watch movies in the vein of a project you're developing for research and inspiration. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of No Set Path. If you enjoyed this episode, please feel free to rate it and share it with a friend, especially if you can think of someone who might benefit from the knowledge that was shared here today. You can keep up with the podcast on all social platforms at No Set Path Show or on the website at www.nosetpathshow.com. Thanks so much for being part of this community, and we'll talk to you soon.